From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. Bob Garfield is away this week. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Chris Bannon.
Some may belittle politics, but we know, who are engaged in it, that it is where people stand tall. It is still the arena that sets the heart beating a little faster. And if it is on occasions the place of low skullduggery, it is more often the place for the pursuit of noble causes. And I wish everyone, friend or foe, well, and that is that, the end.
British Prime Minister Tony Blair stepped down this past Wednesday, ceding control of the Labour Party and its government to longtime Treasury head Gordon Brown. When Blair first took up residence at 10 Downing Street a full decade ago, his political nickname was Bambi, a wry reference to his doe-eyed expressions of optimism.
A new dawn has broken. We have been elected as New Labour, and we will govern as New Labour.
Few Brits would describe him that way now. Blair leaves office deeply unpopular with his own people. Only 22% said in a recent poll that they could trust him. For the first 7 years of his tenure, Blair's image was entrusted to Alistair Campbell, his communications director, and the man often credited with introducing spin doctoring into British politics. He says he was just doing his job.
In general terms, I was always of the view that the press was there and the media was there to help me help Tony get a message across to the public. I never saw my job as being there to help the press.
They would agree, probably.
They certainly would, but I mean, I think what had happened before was that people in the Labour Party really thought, you know, well, we've got to let the media kind of set the agenda for us. Well, you can't do that in politics. You have to try to set the agenda yourself, and that's what we did. And in the early days, it has to be said that because Tony was so attractive, so popular, so appealing as a political figure, the press kind of liked this part of the narrative. You know, the Labour Party's finally getting its act together. They're kind of doing the things they should have been doing for years. And over time, they sort of realized that we really were setting the agenda, and they kind of felt that was their job. But it's interesting, you said in the introduction that Tony has left office and he's deeply unpopular. He's not. He gets a very, very, very bad press most of the time. But actually, how many prime ministers have left office getting a standing ovation from every single member of parliament? Our media in Britain, it kind of doesn't do in between. You're either a hero or you're a zero. What happened was that we were hero for a while, and then after a while, they thought, well, this is kind of boring now. Well, let's make him a zero.
And the give and take between the British government and the press has been described by many as very aggressive and very hostile on both sides. Do you think you played any role in making it more aggressive and more hostile?
I think I did, yeah. And it got a lot worse than I ever wanted it to be or ever planned it to be. Actually, Bill Clinton said something really interesting to me about this. He said to me, look, you've got to try and get back into a situation where they understand you've got a job to do, you understand they've got a job to do, and you shouldn't just constantly always be questioning each other's motives. The Guardian newspaper here described it as sort of an abusive relationship. It really was not pleasant at all. There were many reasons why I left in 2003, but one was that I hoped that maybe me leaving would kind of drain some of the poison from that relationship, but it didn't really, because I think that the media in this country is very different to yours. It's very different to any media, I think, anywhere.
In what ways?
There's a real culture of negativity. That's very, very hard to deal with. And after a while, if you bang your head against a wall for too long, you get a very sore head.
It's hard to believe from our perspective that we're not really negative enough. But if you say so.
I can remember a period in the wake of September the 11th. And he was, as you know, going around the world and taking a very prominent role in the diplomatic activity that followed and the lead up to the war in Afghanistan. And I don't know if I'm allowed to say this on your program, but I recorded my diary at the time. He goes abroad, he's fated everywhere he goes, and we come home and it's like swimming through shit. And that was what it was like most of the time that you were dealing with the domestic media.
Do you feel that you helped create the idea of spin? Some people charge that spin didn't exist in Britain before you. Is that true?
Listen, it's always existed at every level of politics. What didn't exist in Britain before we came along was 24-hour news, 7 days a week, 365 days a year, news, news, news. And they couldn't be bothered to go and do kind of policy stuff. They just loved to talk about me and about spin and all the rest of it. And spin is, you know, what is it anymore? Political communication is not just legitimate. It's an essential part of modern politics. Democratic politicians have got a duty to explain to their publics all the time what it is that they're doing. Now, in the modern media age, you need professional support to do that properly. And that's what I did. Big deal.
Alistair Campbell, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you.
Alistair Campbell was Director of Communications and Strategy under British Prime Minister Tony Blair from 1994 to 2003. His book, The Blair Years, will be published next month.
A day like today, I mean, it's not a day for sort of sound bites, really. We can leave those at home, but I feel the hand of history upon our shoulder.
This week, John Edwards launched TV spots in the Granite State and Barack Obama entered the Iowa airwaves. We know who's paying for those ads. The candidates themselves claim responsibility at the end of each one. Less transparent are the so-called issue ads, paid for by groups who claim to be supporting a specific policy position, not a candidate. When those ads started showing up in the mid-90s, they were mostly unregulated. But in 2002, the McCain-Feingold Act ruled that if an ad funded by, say, a corporation or a union mentioned a specific candidate, it was an election ad, not an issue ad, and therefore could not run in the 2 months leading up to a general election. That limited the impact those groups could have. This week, the Supreme Court ruled that ban unconstitutional, saying that unions and corporations have a First Amendment right to spend their money however and whenever they want, as long as they don't say, vote for candidate X. Political scientist David Magleby says the decision will turn the clock back to the bad old days when election spots disguised as issue ads and unregulated party money, soft money, flooded the airwaves with negativity.
Before McCain-Feingold, it was the Wild West, and soft money party spending, when combined with issue advocacy, equaled or often was greater than what the candidates were spending. In that sense, then, the candidates lost control of their own messages. They were being defined to the voters by corporations, unions, and money coming into the parties that was outside of their control.
Okay, that was before. Then after McCain-Feingold?
What was different in 2004 and 2006 as a result of McCain-Feingold was individuals, you and me and anybody else who writes a check to a candidate, became much, much more important to the candidates. McCain-Feingold doubled the amount of money that candidates could take from individuals. It substituted issue advocacy or soft money, and to some extent PAC money, for individual money. And what no one expected but what has happened is individuals have stepped up in a major way, and you're seeing it already in this cycle in the presidential race, where they're contributing record-setting amounts to the candidates. That money is fully disclosed, and it's limited.
So how will things change now after this Supreme Court decision?
The winning candidate in an election is going to often be much more appreciative of his friends in the corporate sector or the unions than he would have been before, because they're spending issue advocacy money to attack his opponent may well help elect him. So this decision substantially increases the power and influence of corporations and unions, and it substantially diminishes the power of individual contributors.
And does all this hinge on how we go about distinguishing between what is an election ad and what is an issue ad? Because there's always been a problem in distinguishing between those ads, right? There aren't any issues during an election season that are separate from candidates.
Exactly. And it doesn't make sense that unions and corporations would want to advertise about issues not related to the election in that season, paying these outrageous rates for them if it wasn't about the election also. This is about the election or the defeat of a candidate. And that's another point that I think is critical. Virtually all of this advertising is negative. This is attack ads. And it's often irresponsible. And it can be that way because the groups, that is unions or corporations or other groups, can hide behind an innocuous name. So Republicans for Clean Air attacked John McCain on the eve of the New York primary, and no one knew who they were. We later learned that they're two brothers from Texas named Wiley, who bankrolled that themselves, but they named themselves Republicans for Clean Air. What's happening now is you're going to see groups attacking candidates. Politicians will say what we saw in the era of issue advocacy, 96 through 2002. That's not me saying that about my opponent. But I do think my opponent ought to answer the charges.
But we did see it in 2004. It didn't go away. You had the so-called 527 groups like MoveOn.org and the Swift Boat Veterans for Truth. And now you've got the internet where people can craft their own ads and put them up there. I mean, hasn't the candidate really lost control of his or her message already?
They are substantially at the mercy of 527 groups, but that just exponentially increased with the Supreme Court ruling, because that now allows corporate and union treasury money, which could not go to 527s, to enter the playing field as it did in 98, 2000, 2002. So what I'm saying to you is there are going to be far more resources to swift boat somebody than there were in 2004.
You know, David, a lot of people applaud this decision. People who wanted this change ranged from, you know, the ACLU to the National Rifle Association. They see it as a simple free speech issue, and they say the more we hear and talk about public policy, the better. Obviously, other people say this doesn't make speech freer, it makes it more expensive. But what do you think of this line of thinking, which is being presented by people with whom you might normally agree?
Well, I think there is a balancing act that has to happen in our democracy, and I think the efforts to regulate corporate and union treasury funds were wise because those entities have so much access to resources well beyond what other groups and individuals have that they can drown out everyone else's voice. And there is evidence to believe from the 96 through the 2002 cycles that they're prepared to try to do so when they really care about something. So there's multiple values on the table here, one of which is free speech, but another is the viability of our electoral democracy.
David, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
David Magleby is a political science professor at Brigham Young University.
Coming up, yet another rhetorical shift in the telling of the Iraq War. And later, two undercover reporters come out of the shadows.
This is On the Media from NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Chris Bannon.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. When the so-called troop surge began in Baghdad this year, we heard a lot about the threat of the Shiite militias there. Now we're hearing more about Sunni insurgents, specifically al-Qaeda in Iraq. That group, we're told, is the focus of a new offensive in the Diyala province. On Wednesday, CNN's Wolf Blitzer asked Brigadier General Kevin Bergner which was the biggest problem right now, al-Qaeda in Iraq or the insurgency at large.
Well, Wolf, you know, this is a complex environment. It's a place that's a mosaic of different threats and problems. But al-Qaeda has clearly been the main engine fueling the sectarian violence and driving this violence in Iraq.
News coverage reflects the Pentagon's focus on al-Qaeda in Iraq. The group is often mentioned, usually without any analysis of what exactly it is. And that bothers Mike Drummond. He's a correspondent for McClatchy Newspapers, just arrived in Iraq for a second reporting tour there. Last weekend he wrote that, quote, "The Bush administration's recent shift toward calling the enemy in Iraq al-Qaeda rather than an insurgency may reflect the difficulty in maintaining support for the war at home more than it does the nature of the enemy in Iraq." We asked Drummond why he's so skeptical.
You know, last year, al-Qaeda in Iraq was rarely mentioned, and now it's mentioned multiple times daily. Over the last week, even, they've mentioned it 33 times in a barrage of press releases, whereas just last month, they mentioned it all of 9 times.
Is there any way for you or your staff to independently verify what you're hearing about the presence of al-Qaeda in the Diyala province? I mean, can you go up there and have a look around yourself?
We do have a stringer there on the ground right now in Diyala. And what he's seeing is all sorts of what the U.S. military used to term as rogue elements. Among them is al-Qaeda in Iraq, but you also have Shiite militiamen, you also have Sunni tribesmen, and you have other sort of criminal opportunists. I do think the U.S. military has a default, a de facto sort of identifier they use now, and that is al-Qaeda in Iraq.
And you don't think it's really justified by the forces on the ground, or is there even any way to know?
I'm not saying that al-Qaeda in Iraq doesn't exist. I'm not saying that at all. I'm just saying let's be cautious in embracing the loaded term al-Qaeda. It's a not-so-subtle link to 9/11. And too often you're seeing reports from here on the ground, particularly among my embedded colleagues, who are just using Al-Qaeda without any qualifiers.
Right. But I mean, you've been there, you know, all of 8 days. Are you in a position to be skeptical of those people embedded writing that it's Al-Qaeda, 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 when you haven't been there long enough to see who it is exactly?
I appreciate your challenge on that. And you're right. Actually, it takes several weeks, if not months, to really get the story. And all I'm suggesting is, I think there's a way that we can qualify that term, Al-Qaeda. And we often do by saying, you know, according to U.S. military officials, it was Al-Qaeda in Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
We could use phrasing like that, you know, or even snicker quotes. Too often, I don't know, in my thinking, it could be used as sort of indolent shorthand. I'll admit I'm probably guilty of using that indolent shorthand as well. But, you know, we shouldn't risk eroding our credibility to save space in the newspaper. Spin is the U.S. government's job. I think our job as journalists should be a little bit more neutral on this.
And you think, as you stated in your piece, that's why the term has become the current term of art, because the support for the war is waning so much. There's no place to turn except for that association with 9/11.
It certainly makes the war more palatable. You know, support for the war at home is at an all-time low. And who among us would oppose fighting Al-Qaeda?
You know, one reason why we wanted to talk to you so much is because the McClatchy News Agency, which used to be Knight Ridder, was one of the very few organizations that seemed to be appropriately skeptical when it came to statements made by the Bush administration in the run-up to the war. Is this something that people at McClatchy talk about over coffee? You know, let's not be pushovers. Does it become a reflex after a while, or you think it just is as necessary as ever?
Well, you know, there's that axiom in journalism that goes, your mother says she loves you, check it out. And that's sort of ingrained in our culture. You know, as a smaller news organization, we don't have major papers in the Beltway or New York. And so we often don't get the top level access that our larger brethren enjoy. So we often rely on, I guess, for lack of a better term, second tier sources. And I think because we're not in that upper tier, we rely more on a healthier sense of skepticism. I think that has served us and it is serving us very well.
Mike, thank you very much.
Oh, it's been my pleasure, Brooke.
Mike Drummond is interim Baghdad bureau chief for McClatchy Newspapers.
In the years since 9/11, Carl Prine, an investigative reporter for the Pittsburgh Tribune Review, has worn away lots of shoe leather exposing how vulnerable America is to terrorist attack. A veteran of the first Iraq War with training in chemicals, Prine became concerned after reading that blueprints of U.S. chemical plants were found in the effects of 9/11 hijacker Mohammed Atta and in Al-Qaeda hideouts in Tora Bora. That launched Prine on a nearly six-year beat that has brought attention to both his findings and his tactics. He began by walking into supposedly secure, high-risk chemical storage facilities, and then he wrote about how easy it was to gain access.
You could put your hand on the tank, you could jump all over it, you could photograph yourself on it, and you could leave. If I'd wanted to kill tens of thousands of people in our major American cities, I could have done it.
Your editors obviously said, yes, go ahead and do this, but did they say, here's where you have to draw the line, here's what you can't do?
Sure. You know, we have some of those rules. We don't want to break any laws. So if there's a no trespassing sign, I don't cross it. If there's a lock, I won't jimmy it. If there's a fence, I won't climb it. I hate to tell you that over the years, I've never had to do any of that. That people leave their gates open. Smokers are notorious for leaving buildings open. If you stake out a place long enough, you'll see through the process of human error many ways you can get into a plant and out of a plant without anybody even noticing you were there.
So the series ran, and how did your audience, I mean, it ran in Pittsburgh, and I assume it was picked up in other newspapers around the country. How did your readers react?
The first time we did our stories on fixed facilities, they tended to be more supportive. This was in 2002. There was still a sense that the country had pulled together and that we all needed to get a plan that would protect everybody. As years have gone by, and as we've gone into a war in Iraq, it's become much more of a patriotic issue, that if you raise these questions, you're being inherently unpatriotic and that you are abetting the enemy. That's been a real sea shift. Perhaps I should have noticed that, but I didn't notice that coming.
Do you see any part of that argument that you could agree with? I mean, you're publishing information and essentially what could look to many people like a blueprint for how to do this. Is it valid for people to be worried about?
Actually, I think it is valid for people to worry about that. There's always a problem. If you don't publicize something, then there's never any accountability for it. So they won't change their practices. The government won't do what they're supposed to do to protect the homeland. So our way around a lot of these nettlesome issues is to, whenever I do one of these stories, I give all the photographs and all the information to the facility security managers or the railroad managers at least a month or two in advance so they can see exactly how I was able to get to where I needed to go. I also give all this information to government, whether it's local, state, or federal, anybody who wants to see it so they can remedy any security defects.
Have you gone back to see if the plants changed in the month, say, between when you gave them the information and when it was published?
Yeah, I did that in 2003. I went with 60 Minutes, and we went through a number of chemical plants. What I found is, at that point, they really hadn't done it. They had said they were going to make changes, but they never really did. And there wasn't really a statutory framework for them to have to do so.
Well, you decided to serve your government. You had served in the Marines before, and in 2005, you reenlisted in the National Guard, and you were sent to Iraq. Was it hard transitioning from someone who pokes around and asks difficult questions into somebody who has to take orders and do what he's told every day?
Yes and no. I wanted to serve my country again. I thought I understood transnational terrorism very well, and I went into fight. About there for 8 months in Anbar province. We were between Ramadi and Fallujah, and what then was the hotbed of the rebellion. So it was what the Army would call a very kinetic environment. This is a counterinsurgency war, and it's a war that requires what they call strategic corporals to basically think like a reporter. Your job is to develop sources in a community, is to analyze data very quickly, to rapidly make decisions that are important on deadline.
So when you came back, did the chemical storage beat, did it look different to you?
I had less patience for a lot of stories that were being told out there by FLAX. For example, I remember I would call up a railroad official and he would say, well, there's no way possible a terrorist could blow up a rail car. Now, I think once you've seen an armored vehicle melted and you're pulling out bodies of people that you knew, you have a lot less patience for people who suggest that a bomb maker can't possibly fathom a way to open up a chlorine rail car. It's ludicrous, absolutely ludicrous. I think the stories that I do are really footnotes to a larger series of questions. What is the role of the press in a free society? How much deference should we give to political or military leaders in a lot of these decisions? How informed do we need to be as a nation about many of the threats that face us? I want our stories to force a conversation. The only part that I really don't like is when they question my patriotism. That really bothers me, because the only reason why I was in Iraq was because of my patriotism. I'm hearing this now more and more. Journalists have lost the war in Iraq. Journalists are helping terrorists. This personally offends me. It's a disgusting thing to say.
Well, Carl, thanks very much for joining us on the media.
No problem.
Carl Prine is an investigative reporter for the Pittsburgh Tribune. The PBS series Exposé began its season with a look at Carl's work. The episodes are available at www.pbs.org/exposé.
I went to the Naval Research Institute, the best scientists we have. I said, what would happen if somebody stuck plastique, like Carl stuck his card, on a chlorine gas tanker car, and it was remotely detonated? They said up to 100,000 people could die in a populated area.
In March 2007, Biden proposed an amendment to a security bill calling for more rail police, rerouting away from major cities, and replacing lethal chemicals with safer alternatives. Biden could not overcome stiff opposition from the rail and chemical industries. His amendment was voted down.
How do you make a nasty old dictatorship seem just a little friendlier? Well, try hiring a lobbyist. Recently, Harper's Magazine Washington editor Ken Silverstein went undercover, posing as a business consultant looking to hire a lobbying firm. The mission? To put a PR sheen on Turkmenistan, a country with an appalling human rights record. Two D.C.-based firms, APCO and Cassidy & Associates, bid for the job. After Silverstein's report appeared in the July Harper's, those firms and a few journalists criticized Silverstein's covert tactics, charging that he misrepresented himself to get a story. We reached Silverstein in his newsroom, where he said the criticism should be focused on the lobbying firms and on the many promises they made in their eagerness to revamp Turkmenistan's public image. Among those promises, carefully choreographed panel discussions.
You know, they said, you pay us $25,000, it'll look independent, but we'll have total control over the agenda and who's on stage, so your point of view will be gotten across. Both of them talked about how they could basically plant op-eds in the newspaper. And APCO told me they had someone on staff that did nothing but that. You know, their 9-to-5 job apparently is planting bogus op-eds. They talked about arranging congressional delegations to go over to Turkmenistan. Both said in the post-Jack Abramoff climate, we have to be a little careful here because, you know, there's been a lot of scrutiny of all of this sort of thing, but we think we can do it. You know, they both said that getting a group of staffers to go over would not be a problem, take a little bit more work to get the members of Congress themselves, but they both expressed confidence that they could do it. Now, APCO actually already was thinking about how they might do it, and they said we could get a Turkmen university to sponsor the trip. There's a loophole in the law that allows if you can find a university to sponsor a trip, then you can get away with it. They didn't say they would break the law. I mean, what we wanted to demonstrate was that the law is so flimsy that they don't really need to break the law in order to evade the spirit of the law.
So you go in, you have these meetings. How much did APCO and how much did Cassidy decide they needed to charge you?
Well, APCO said that it was going to cost about $600,000 over the first year. It was $40,000 a month in fees. But then in addition to that, there would be expenses. Mm-hmm. There would be $35,000 to redo the Turkmen Embassy's website, which admittedly, as I note in this story, was a little out of date. The recent news on the website dated, I think, to 2000, and there was an exciting story about machines harvesting cotton on virgin land.
Well, they had other priorities, I guess.
Cassidy said to me, you know, with Turkmenistan, there are no quick, easy solutions. We're going to have to do this over 3 years, $1.2 to $1.5 million a year, plus, of course, the expenses.
And how would they address criticisms of rights abuses in places like Turkmenistan? Do they have a strategy for dealing with, you know, a human rights campaign by someone in the State Department or in government or in media?
Yeah, Cassidy had a plan. They said, if there is, in fact, you know, one of these nonprofit groups, like human rights groups that targets Turkmenistan, it's going to cost you more because we're going to have to work harder to sort of dampen down the criticism of the regime.
But they didn't seem particularly squeamish about dealing with it.
Absolutely not.
Okay, but is this really news? I mean, lobbyists will take clients from all kinds of backgrounds, many of whom we wouldn't approve of.
Well, I'd say it's news for a couple of reasons. I mean, if everything's fine and dandy, and if we know that this is, after all, they're just expected to do this, then why did the new Congress feel so compelled to take up lobby reform as one of its very first priorities? And why is it, in fact, that despite claiming that that would be the first thing they did, why haven't they done it yet? That's another interesting question, and I think it speaks to the public interest nature of the story. So, yeah, I mean, sure, we know it's a bad situation, but I don't think the public is so accepting of the situation as maybe a lot of people in Washington are.
I just want to ask you, how did you dress yourself? How did you appear in order to show up at these lobbying firms? Did you assume a disguise? What did you do?
I did because I've worked in Washington for about 15 years as a reporter, and because, in fact, I'd reported on several of the firms I approached as well, I did take some precautions. I did change my beard, and I put on a pair of fake glasses. And I went out and bought, because I don't own a very fancy suit, because I'm not a very fancy reporter.
You're a reporter, after all. Yeah.
That's right. And I went out and bought a much, much more expensive suit than I would normally dress in.
Did you get to keep the suit?
I did get to keep the suit. Okay. Very exciting. Now I can look good when I need to appear on TV.
So you went undercover to conduct this story, and going undercover can always raise issues for any journalist. Howard Kurtz in the Washington Post wrote recently that no matter how good the story, lying to get it raises as many questions about journalists as their subjects. He's a little afraid, it seems to me, that the value of what you're getting from undercover reporting is undercut by the ways in which that method can be perceived and used as a sort of cudgel against journalists.
Well, I think there was a legitimate public interest served here, and I think it was a legitimate use of the tactic. I also would say, if I may,
sure,
that I think there's a slight irony in some ways to the criticism of the undercover tactic in this case. I mean, to me, you know, it's okay for these lobbying firms to plant op-eds and to create bogus news events and to manipulate the media. But it's not okay for me to expose their dirty linen. I find that somewhat ironic. Believe me, I'm not trying to suggest that. I'm not open to question on it. We knew going in that we would be questioned about, did you need to use the undercover tactic? It's a fair question. I think we have good answers. It's up for, I guess, the readers of the magazine to decide.
Well, listen, the suit looks great on you, Ken.
Thank you.
Thanks very much for joining us. Ken Silverstein is the Washington editor of Harper's Magazine.
Coming up, science fiction writers take on real-life disaster planning, and our favorite replicants turn 25.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for On the Media comes from the Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, the foundation of entrepreneurship, on the web at kauffman.org. The John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world, at macfound.org. And the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Chris Bannon.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Last week, we devoted the entire show to the subject of press freedom in Russia. The response was very positive, but not entirely. A few of you were irked by what you thought was overlooked. Vel Nertist, for one. Vel wrote, quote, "While Brooke Gladstone's points were well taken, one needs to keep in mind that there are a good many issues with free speech right here in the U.S. that stem not from politics, but from economics, which doesn't make them any less serious." Alan Wright from Westchester, Pennsylvania, agreed, writing that, quote, "Your description of the subtle ways in which voices and perspectives critical of the dominant system in Russia are shunted to minor media struck me as identical to the ways in which truly progressive voices in the U.S. are restricted by some invisible hand to small circulation publications such as The Nation."
We received this from Irina Pecherskaya from San Francisco. Quote, "I have lived the first half of my life in the USSR and the second half in the USA. I am simply amazed at this show. For the whole hour, there has been no statement, qualification, attitude, or representation that I, as a native, would find uninformed, missing the point, or overlooking a subtlety of the modern life in Russia. Thank you. I learned something new about my country from your show." And Michelle Hadley of River Falls, Wisconsin, wrote in to say that she, quote, "personally enjoys the country-focused format. Expense, I'm sure, makes these programs prohibitive on a regular basis, but they are very informative and valuable." Next up, China.
Actually, Irina and Michelle are among the early adopters in our audience who have already figured out how to take advantage of our newest online gadget, comments. Go to any segment, click on the comments link, and your thoughts will immediately be published online. Now, not only do we see your comments, but your fellow listeners do too, and that has its advantages. For example, a few of you wondered where to find more music from the Russian bard I interviewed. Before we could answer, fellow OTM listeners had already posted the answers. So now you can speak your mind on the comments section of our website and write to our inbox at onthemedia@wnyc.org. But please don't forget to tell us where you live and how to pronounce your name. The 9/11 Commission called the 2001 terrorist attacks a failure of the imagination, namely the government's failure, and one that apparently it hopes to remedy with the help of Sigma, a group of hard science fiction writers. The group was founded by Dr. Arlen Andrews, a scientist and science fiction writer who has served on various White House panels and in many official capacities. Last month, Sigma members were among the attendees at a Department of Homeland Security conference in Washington. The Homeland Security man Chris Christopher, who initially called for collaboration with the science fiction and fantasy writers, put it this way, quote, "If you think what you've always thought, you'll get what you've always got." Sigma founder Arlen Andrews answered his call and ours. Arlen, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to be here.
So what is it about science fiction writers as opposed to, say, playwrights that make them qualified to advise Homeland Security?
We are probably the only professional group in the country, maybe the world, that has spent most of our entire careers living in the future.
And you are quoted as saying that you formed Sigma because you'd heard more original and appropriate futurism on panels at any given science fiction convention than in all the forecasting meetings you ever attended in Washington, D.C.
Yes. One of my jobs when I was working at the White House Science Office back in 1992 for the first Bush administration, there was a congressionally mandated act that says there has to be a critical technologies institute that's supposed to advise the government on the technologies of 10 years in the future so that government grant writers would know what's coming up and maybe they should start allocating money and paying attention to different technologies. Well, I attended several meetings at a critical technology institute. I remember one fellow, leading head of engineering for National Science Foundation, mentioned that in 10 years, micro machines and nanotechnology would probably be important. They laughed at him. A month or so later, I was privileged to be at a meeting in the Roosevelt Room of the White House when Dr. Alan Bromley, who was President Bush's science advisor back then, mentioned that in the future, computer visualization, ways to display data would be very important. And as we all know, they are today in various forms. They laughed at him and said, sure, Alan, we'll put your video games in these projections.
So what kinds of things were you offering at the conference?
Well, Department of Homeland Security is interested in border security. They're interested in inspecting cargoes that come in. They want to be able to respond better to natural disasters like Katrina and earthquakes and tornadoes and that sort of thing. And so in many cases, we didn't give them ray guns and aliens and penetrating armor that, you know, is intelligent and that sort of thing. One of our writers, David Brin, who's very famous, he wrote the basis of the Kevin Costner movie, The Postman. He came up with the concept that is low-tech for this group. It's called citizen tech. He thinks that individual citizens should be empowered, and we should have things like we used to have in the old days, back in the 50s, a civil defense organization. I think Katrina is a perfect example of how citizen tech was not used. All those people down there, had they had a little bit of training and the cell phones and the proper cell phone towers and a civil defense colonel or sergeant on each block said, hey, folks, get out of here. We've got the school buses down here. We could utilize that so that some of the people in FEMA, the mayor of New Orleans, and the governor of Louisiana could be bypassed. The people know what to do. They just go do it.
You say that the Department of Homeland Security was asking you for some ideas of how to deal with the problems that they're confronting, say, with regard to our ports and so on. Did they also ask you to conceive of future disaster scenarios?
One of the proposals that one of our group had said that in the future, some of us think there's a strong possibility that Al-Qaeda or someone else will set off 5 to 10 nukes simultaneously around the country. The fellow asked, in fact, it was Jerry Parnell, asked the DHS official, do you have in mind what kind of regulations and laws, martial law, whatever else, that you're going to need after that fact occurs? Because most people realize that today, the Patriot Act, had it been written before 9/11, would be a lot different. But it was written in extreme political pressure and fear, anxiety, and worry about the next attack. So they threw everything together. Jerry gave them the option right now, says, go back and think. What happens when our big cities are all wiped out? No traffic is allowed on interstates. Communications have been zapped by some e-bomb, as our member Doug Beeson has talked about, and everything's fried. How do you respond locally? If we lose 10 million people in one day, the next day is going to be pure hell for everybody. But still, we have to respond. And so what we do is think about it now when we have plenty of time and there's no pressure and there's no fear.
No fear. Aside from having the living crap scared out of me just now by what you said, I am also struck by the fact that these ideas that these hard science fiction writers are offering have to do with organizing locals to confront a disaster when it happens and to create a legal system that could help sustain the country in the time of unimaginable disaster. Neither of these things involve communicators, death rays, or jetpacks.
That's quite true. Science fiction writers, the successful ones at least, talk about the impact of events and technologies on people and society, not the gadgets themselves. That's why my own favorite stories take place in the next 50 years or so. Occasionally, if you read something, it takes place a billion years from now. that's fine, but somehow it has to tie back to us, because who's really interested in when all the stars and galaxies die unless somebody from now is there talking about it.
So, Arlen, one last question. Why don't we have jetpacks?
Actually, we do. I saw something just last weekend. There are two available right now. One is $150,000 that lasts about 60 seconds, and one is $250,000 that lasts about 90 seconds. Feel free to go ahead. I'm sure they would like to sell some to you.
Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Arlen Andrews is the founder of Sigma, a science fiction writer and an environmental program manager for the U.S. Navy at Corpus Christi, Texas.
The movie Blade Runner debuted in American theaters 25 years ago this week. A science fiction classic that transcended the genre, the film, based on a novel by Philip K. Dick, is considered to be one of the best, perhaps the best, science fiction film ever made. Blade Runner tells the story of a lawman named Deckard who specializes in killing genetically engineered humanoids called replicants, created to labor on other planets. They have brief lifespans tightly controlled by their human masters, and several have escaped to Earth to find a way to extend their lives. That is a capital crime. In director Ridley Scott's vision of Los Angeles in the year 2019, Blade Runner is an allegory that combines several very contemporary themes. One of those is racism. On the media's Philip Martin pulls at that strand in the dystopic tapestry that is Blade Runner.
Not long into Blade Runner's opening scene, a fire-breathing tower set against a cold black sky, Rick Deckard is whisked off to police headquarters. In the original Warner Brothers release, we hear the voiceover of Deckard, ex-detective, ex-Blade Runner, who's forced out of retirement for one last time to kill replicants who've returned to Earth from a colonized planet. This version of the film left no room for ambiguity, as far as race was concerned. Here, Deckard, played by Harrison Ford, reluctantly meets with his ex-boss.
You wouldn't have come if I just asked you to. Sit down, pal.
I've got four skin jobs walking the streets.
Skin jobs? That's what Bryant called replicants. In history books, he's the kind of cop used to call black men niggers.
Since race is widely viewed as a social construct, then it can be easily reconstructed, at least in the movies. Hayden Guest used to direct Warner Brothers Film Archives and does the same job now for Harvard University.
The replicants are an extreme other. I mean, they're in fact a enslaved race, and they're quite literally being driven extinct. I mean, here being assassinated, being killed one by one by the Blade Runner.
When Blade Runner was released in 1982, the producers demanded that Deckard's inner thoughts be expressed through voiceovers, a device Ridley Scott eliminated in his director's cut. Race and racism were issues pressing hard against America's consciousness, but Scott believed those themes spoke for themselves in the set, action, and dialogue.
Quite an experience to live in fear, isn't it? That's what it is to be a slave.
In Blade Runner, the predominant other among the replicants was the so-called Nexus 6 model named Roy Batty, played by Dutch actor Rutger Hauer.
The irony is that the maker has sort of put a stamp on them, Nexus 6, you know, more human than human, at the same time that Harrison Ford's character, Deckard, seems to be rather poor in the human aspect. He's a slave in his own way.
It was no accident that the setting for Blade Runner was Los Angeles, which these days is a cauldron of ethnic clashes and cultural melding. In director Ridley Scott's vision of the future, L.A. is the literal crossroads of East and West, personified by Edward James Olmos's character, a Blade Runner named Gaff. He confronts Deckard, who's chowing down at one of the ubiquitous noodle stalls in this futurescape.
Lofa, nehojma, devaja Blade Runner.
He say you Blade Runner.
Tell him I'm eating. That gibberish he talked was city speak, gutter talk, a mishmash of Japanese, Spanish, German, what have you. I didn't really need a translator. I knew the lingo every good cop did.
My character was 10 different cultures all in one.
We reached Edward James Olmos on his cell phone in Vancouver on the set of his TV series, Battlestar Galactica.
We got the Asian influence blended together, and the city speak became something that, you know, we've seen even today in 2007. We don't have to wait to 2019.
In terms of, like, how futurists make predictions, they're vision of L.A. being overrun by the other was distinctly more Asian than the current paranoias.
L.A. writer Gary Dauphin says the current paranoias are focused on Mexico.
L.A. is L.A. is a Chicano city, and I think that to the extent that downtown reflects that, it's different than what's depicted in the film.
What the film depicts is a future where Mexicans, blacks, and Asians do not bear the brunt of fear, hate, and suspicion, partly because there are no blacks and few Latinos in this dystopic vision of the future. The movie came out when Hollywood was in short supply of both. Instead, we see replicants who, like the historical image of African Americans, are seen through the prism of untamed physical strength, entertainment, and sexuality. In fact, one of the replicants pursued by Deckard is a kind of sexual plaything. One is a dancer, one is a manual laborer. Harvard film archivist Hayden Guest.
So much is stressed on their physicality, you know, the actual bodies at the end, where, you know, they're doing physical stunts throughout the film, and so much is emphasis is placed on this. They're actually fighting for their lives. They express themselves predominantly through their bodies.
Why are you staring at us, Sebastian?
Because you're so different. You're so perfect.
Yes.
What generation are you?
Nexus 6.
Ah, I knew it. Because I do genetic design work for the Terrell Corporation. There's some of me in you. Show me something.
Like what?
Like anything.
We're no computers, Sebastian. We're physical.
In 1982, on sets throughout Hollywood, black actors were being cast as iron macho men, pimps, or as sex machines, as in Shaft or Superfly. At the other extreme, they were portrayed as utterly without sex or anger, but rather as secular saints. You find reflections of that kind of portrayal in the Matrix series and satirized in such films as Bruce Almighty and, more recently, Evan Almighty, where Morgan Freeman literally plays God. In Blade Runner, Roy Batty is a kind of God. He seems to fly. He is pierced and bloodied in a subtle allusion to stigmata. He transcends his agony and achieves grace. Rutger Hauer has co-authored a new book about his Blade Runner role, titled All Those Moments.
It's an investigation in humanity and life that we're not that familiar with, and in that way sort of, you know, expands your horizon. The story of Blade Runner is almost an excuse to revalue what humanity is about.
I've seen things you people wouldn't believe. Attack ships on fire off the shoulder of Orion. I watched sea beams glitter in the dark near the Tannhauser Gate. All those moments will be lost in time, like tears in rain. Time to die.
He dies, no longer a slave, a second-class human, defined by the manner of his creation or his genetic code. He is just a creature of his senses, a mortal man who would have liked to live a little longer. It is for Hollywood a profound and poetic statement about the inescapable brotherhood of man and the principal reason why Blade Runner endures. For On the Media, I'm Philip Martin.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Tony Field, Jamie York, Mike Volo, and Nazanin Rafsanjani, and edited by Brooke. Dylan Keefe is our technical director, and Jennifer Munson, our engineer. We had help from Andrea Ambro and Madeline Elish.
Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer, and John Keefe, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find free transcripts, MP3 downloads, and our podcast at onthemedia.org, and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
Bob Garfield will be back next week. I'm Chris Bannon.
On the Media is supported by the Bidell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.